Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economic ecology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. On today's program, Lynn Olson, Elizabeth Berg, and Elizabeth Letts all join me on the stage of the City Opera House to talk about their work. Author and journalist Lynn Olson is known for her books about history, especially World War II. Her latest is Madame Fourcade's Secret War. Elizabeth Berg writes novels such as Open House and The Story of Arthur Truelove. And Elizabeth Letts writes books of nonfiction and historical fiction. Her latest is about The Wizard of Oz author Frank L. Baum's wife, Maud Baum. I asked each author to describe their latest book. Lynn Olson went first.
My book is a true story. It's the story of a young, elegant, beautiful French woman, the mother of two young children, who just happened to be the leader of the largest and most influential French intelligence network during World War II, and what her network was doing was gathering information about the Nazis in France. Got involved in the network when she was 30 years old. She became the leader of the network at the age of 31 when the leader was captured by the Gestapo, and she continued leading this network for the rest of the war as the Gestapo captured many of her agents. And I should emphasize that these agents were not professional spies. They were not trained spies. They were ordinary people like you and me, from truck drivers to fishermen to lawyers to artists to students to even the most famous child actor in France was one of her agents. But they were united in their determination to get rid of this occupying power and to regain their freedom and independence, and that's what drove them. And so they spent the war basically risking their lives every day to gather information that would help the Allies defeat the Germans, not only in France but the rest of Europe. And among the achievements they had was contributed a 55-foot-long map for D-Day, which showed every gun emplacement, every anti-tank, every road, everything on the exact beaches that the Allies landed on D-Day. Her story is just a story of adventure. She's constantly on the run from the Gestapo. She gets captured, she escapes. But it's more of what she accomplished and what these other people accomplished in the face of tremendous odds.
Thank you. Elizabeth?
So my book is called The Story of Arthur Truelove. The first sentence is, in the 6 months since his wife died, Arthur Moses has been having lunch with her every day. So what he does is he rides the bus out to the cemetery and he sits on a little fold-up chair and he communes with her to the best of his ability, not only with her, but with other souls in the cemetery. One day he sees a goth girl sitting at the base of a tree, a teenager with a nose ring that he thinks looks like a booger. And they are two very dissimilar personalities, but they become friends. And in fact, Arthur ends up hiring Maddie, is her name, to be his housekeeper. And then yet a third person moves into that household, and there's a very interesting cat who lives there as well. So it's a story about people coming together to support each other, and you wouldn't necessarily think that they might. I wrote it because I needed to write about really decent people. I needed to remember kindness and goodness. Remember it? Remember? And it really was that purposeful. I was so tired of feeling depressed and bleak all the time. I created a fictional town called Mason. And it doesn't shy away from the fact that there are problems and sorrows in the world, but it's a place, if you read the book, you're reminded that most of us are mostly good and the worth of kindness.
I just want to interject before we go to Elizabeth Letts. As I read all three books cover to cover, and each one was a completely different experience, but yet there were some themes and similarities wherein we have Marie Madeleine Fourcade and we have Arthur Moses or True Love. Mm-hmm. They're trying to create a better world. They're subversive people in a way. Exactly. They're people out of their time in a way because mm-hmm. they're going against the grain. And that's what's interesting about this trio, leading us to Maud Baum of Wizard of Oz fame, who is to be reckoned with in her own way.
That's right. I just want to ask a quick question, which is how many people in this room have seen The Wizard of Oz?
Probably everybody.
And how many of you saw it on TV for the first time, not in a theater? And just one more question. When you think of The Wizard of Oz, how many of you kind of remember the scent of that old Jiffy Pop, the red one and the blue one that you... Me too. So I didn't know I was going to write a story about The Wizard of Oz. Those of you who maybe are familiar with me, my last two books were nonfiction books about horses. But unfortunately for me, I find my stories in these kind of strange ways, kind of by accident. And that's absolutely true with the story of Finding Dorothy. I did not set out to write a book about the Baum family. I decided to read the book, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, aloud to my son as a bedtime story. It was probably about 6 or 7 years ago. But as I was reading it, I had this very uncanny feeling that there was something very modern about this book that was published in the year 1900. And in particular, there was something about the way that he treated the female characters. And subversive is exactly what I thought. There was this underlying wit and kind of subversiveness that seemed very modern to me. And that's when I realized that I didn't know anything about the man, L. Frank Baum, other than his name, which, being an author, I was like, well, this man, his story is so incredibly well known, but I don't know anything about his life. So I did what I do when I'm curious about something, which is I Wikipedia'd it. And what I discovered, two things. And the two things I discovered was, number one, that Frank Baum had dedicated this book to his wife, Maud. And the dedication was to my good friend and comrade, my wife. And so that made an impression on me. The other thing I realized was that Maud Baum was no ordinary woman. She was one of the first women to attend the Ivy League, and she was the daughter of a woman by the name of Matilda Jocelyn Gage, who was an ardent, radical advocate for the rights of women in the 19th century, a close friend of Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, to the point that when Maud was growing up in her house, Susan B. Anthony had kind of her own room in the house and even carved her name in one of the glass windows. So she grew up as a very unusual young woman. She married Frank Baum. Frank Baum dedicated the book to his wife. But the story of Finding Dorothy is the story of Maud Baum, who was, at the time of the filming of The Wizard of Oz, she was 79 years old. She decided to go to MGM's studio and try to take on the studio heads and protect the legacy of this story, because it wasn't just the story that her husband had made up. It really was a story that was drawn from both of their lives.
Which was marked with peril and bankruptcy, and he was this kind of creative genius, and she stood with him.
She did.
All the way. And you had an amazing moment. You found a photograph with Maud Baum at age 89?
80. She was about 79 at the time.
79,
I think. Yeah.
Sitting with Judy Garland, who's 15.
Yeah.
Talk about that just for a moment.
Well, so when I discovered that Frank was married to this incredible woman, I still didn't actually really realize I had found a story to tell. When I realized I had found a story to tell was when I saw this picture. And it was a picture of Maud. She was 78, and she was seated with Judy Garland, who was 15. Now, Judy Garland, obviously, is this incredibly iconic international star, was. But at the time, she was just a girl. She wasn't famous yet. And Maud was a widow when she was older. And I saw them sitting together, and it just piqued my curiosity. I wanted to know what that relationship was like. I wanted to know what those women would have said to each other, Maud being older, but having been grown up as a staunch advocate for women, and Judy, who obviously was wise beyond her years, or she wouldn't have been able to put that emotion into the singing of Over the Rainbow. There's that kind of very adult feeling in that song, and she was so young. But we know that Judy Garland ended up having a tragic life and in a lot of ways had trouble standing up for herself. And so I wanted to know what that meeting of those two women together would have been like.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Lynn, I like to talk among all of us about this, but get to the reason why your books are resonating with readers. You know, we'll start with you. You wrote, well, you went back to the 19th century in 1939 in Hollywood, but World War II is popular, but I'm just curious briefly, if you can say, why did you write this book? Why did you feel it was important to write it now?
This particular book? Well, I've written 8 books of history. 7 of them have dealt with World War II. And I just find World War II, and particularly Britain and World War II, really fascinating. And I don't have time to explain exactly why, but I do. But one of the things that unites all those books is that they're all about unsung heroes. They're all about people of courage and conscience who somehow have changed their country and even the world, but have fallen into the cracks of history. And Marie-Madeleine Foucaud is a perfect example of this. I wrote about her a tiny, tiny bit in my previous book. And I had read a lot about the French Resistance, and I came across her name a few times, enough to pique my interest, but there was nothing about her. I mean, this is the only woman to head a major French Resistance organization, which was by far the most influential. In her early 30s. Why? Why haven't I heard her? Why haven't other people heard about her? And that's why I decided to write the book, because she had an enormous influence she played a major role. Her network played a huge role in the outcome of the war. And so I decided to try to find out why.
And she's like, 39 in 1941. She's married. She has children already.
She's only 30.
30.
19. Yeah, she's really young. Two young kids.
There's something so interesting at the end of your book, which we'll get then to Elizabeth and Arthur Truelove, about what a person that you quote named Jean Rousseau says about, which seems to go to the heart of what we do as storytellers, which is our job is to be witnesses, to be empathic, and we have moral obligations to kind of rise and stand up
right.
and tell the stories of our time.
Right.
And could you tell us what Rousseau said?
Okay, if I can remember it. Actually, do you have it? Why don't you read it, and
I'll talk
a little bit about it.
Yes.
Because I'm not sure I can exactly remember it.
Asked why she risked her life to fight the Nazis, Jeannie Rousseau replied, "I don't understand the question. It was a moral obligation to do what you are capable of doing. It was a must. How could you not do it?" And we're talking about the resistance with a capital R
right.
as it pertains to the Gestapo and the Nazis
right.
in World War II.
Right. But what she was saying, I mean, she was bringing it, that interview was done by David Ignatius of the Washington
right.
Post.
Oh, that's right.
In the early 1990s. So you're talking about 50 years after the war. And so she is bringing that into the present. And she is saying to him, you know, you can be talking about World War II, but basically that holds true. It's universal. It's a universal truth. And basically what she is saying, and what these people in this network, it's not just Marie Madeleine, it's the people of her network, they were ordinary people, but what they did, they banded together and they stood up for what they believed and they helped the Allies win, but they also showed what could be done by ordinary people who, by standing up for what they believed, made a huge difference. And I think that's what she was trying to get across,
that
anybody can do this. You know, you're not powerless. Nobody is powerless. If they care enough to do what they believe is right and are courageous enough to do that, then they can make a huge difference. And that's exactly what this group of 3,000 people did.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Lynn Olson talks more about the exciting but dangerous life of the protagonist of her book, Madame Foucaud's Secret War.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to my conversation with Elizabeth Letts, Elizabeth Berg, and Lynn Olson.
Reading the story of Arthur Truelove, it's so sweet and touching. It was like I just devoured it. And reading Madame Fourcade's story, it was so kind of intense and stimulating in a way. And reading then about Maud Baum, the scenes that Elizabeth Letts paints about life in the 1890s and going to the Dakota Prairie, and I'll let you explain how this happens. It's a sweeping book that kind of covers two time periods and two locales. And it's really, to me, a love story between Maud and Frank. And I'll just tell the audience, Maud shows up on the set of MGM and inserts herself into the production of the movie. So when you read the book, which I urge you to do, you actually get to peek behind the curtain of the movie's production. Mm-hmm. And do you agree that it's a love story between the two of them?
I do, and I think, you know, it's an interesting love story because it's a story, it starts with Maud as a widow. And Frank's been gone for almost 20 years when they are going to make the movie. And then it goes all the way back to when she's 10 years old and you meet her as a young, kind of strong-minded woman. And one of the things that I found really interesting about Maud, so I should say that I was raised by a woman who was, I consider, a very strong woman. And my mother is an educated woman. She was an English major and she's 84 now, but she didn't have a career outside the home, which is typical for somebody of her generation. And I think a lot about my mother, that she raised me to be stronger than she was. And I try to raise my daughters to be stronger than I was. And so Maud is an interesting character. I got some pushback, interestingly enough, when I was conceiving of the story, when I started writing it. Actually, I have a literary agent who's a man, and I sent him about the first 100 pages. And he called me up and he said, "I don't understand why you're writing about Maud so much." And I said, "Because the book is about Maud." The truth of the matter is he doesn't work for me anymore. But anyway, this is the way that this ties together is, so Maud was the wife. She was the wife of L. Frank Baum, who was a very celebrated author. But I hope and pray that if you read my story, you will understand that they were, number one, very much partners. Number two, that The Wizard of Oz was his story, but also her story. So she wasn't just kind of protecting him, but she was protecting the life that they had built together. And number three, that the fact that she didn't have, you know, an identifiable career, like her mother, the famous suffragette, and her husband, the famous author, didn't make her any less interesting. In fact, to me, she was compellingly interesting. And part of what made her interesting was that she was married to this man who, while brilliant, was also quite difficult. I mean, he was handsome, and he was charming, he was ebullient, creative. He also couldn't figure out how to make a living. And, you know, he was a chicken farmer, and he was he went to the Dakota Prairie, where it was really quite difficult to do anything. And he decided that what they needed in this tiny, tiny little farm town was an emporium that sold fancy goods and toys.
Like the Wizard of Oz, yeah.
That's right. But so I find that interesting. And one of the things, and if you read my book, you may find that this is a thing, but it's gotten to the point where the people who know me and know about the story, it's almost like all the world is either a Frank or a Maud, and you sort of intuitively know who you are. And you can kind of probably guess which I am. But anyway, it's, you know, we need both kinds of people. We need the people who are the creative dreamers but impractical, but we also need the people who support them. And that's what Frank and Maud were together.
Interesting. What was hard about, I want to just stick on that for a moment. How did you do your research? Many people in the audience like to write and do write, and they're always curious. Because no one's alive in your story, right? And so.
Well, I did my research for the book the same way that I did the research for my nonfiction books, probably the same way that Lynn does her research, which is just a lot of reading. And I went to South Dakota and I looked through the Baum family papers in the local library and saw a collection of things, including some lace that Maud had tatted by hand, which was very meaningful to me for some reason, because she, in the book, she sews to help the family earn a living. And just to see a piece of this lace that she actually had made and just be able to touch it, I thought that was pretty amazing. So it's just learning about the subject. But then when it goes into fiction, then you apply your imagination as well.
Right. So you took a nonfiction story and turned it into a novel.
Mm-hmm.
But your previous two books, The $80 Champion and The Perfect Horse, were mm-hmm. nonfiction books.
Yes.
Can you talk just for a moment about why you chose the fiction path?
Yeah. So that's a really great question. I love historical fiction, and I think historical fiction, in some ways, can be really effective and maybe even more effective than straight history for telling certain stories. And in particular, a lot of times, it'll be a story that there's just not enough in the historical record to fill it in. I find that this often is the case with women's lives or with kind of more run-of-the-mill people whose lives were not recorded. If you're writing about Winston Churchill, I'm sure you can find lots of papers, but the recorded history only goes so far. And so I want you to just stop and think for a minute in your own life and imagine that your grandchild is going to write your biography based on just whatever you left behind, you know, letters, photo albums, emails, whatever. There's a lot your grandchild's not going to know about you. A lot of that's going to be on purpose because you never told, you know, anybody some of the stuff, right? You could keep it private. And that's where fiction comes in. So you do the research, and when you're writing about real people as I did, I stuck to the facts in terms of their life, what we know, and the making of the movie. If I tell you how the costume, what the costume was made of, or something that's a concrete fact, I have looked that up, and that's going to be accurate. But where the imagination takes you, I actually took my inspiration from Frank Baum himself. Frank believed that Oz was a real place, and that the reason that we couldn't see it was because there was kind of this veil between us and these other worlds. And he thought that, you know, he would say, well, Oz is real, and he loved children, because children would say, oh yeah, of course Oz is real. But adults, he would say, well, it's because there's this veil, and if they could just push it aside, they could see past it to this other world. And the fictional world is on the other side, too. You've got to push that veil past. And if you do it right, you can take those characters. You take Frank or Maud, or I had Judy Garland, I had Louis B. Mayer, and it's almost like they say, come on, Elizabeth, come with me, and go through and go beyond that curtain, and you can see. You can sort of see these people live and breathe again. It's pretty incredible. Mm-hmm.
Both Elizabeth and Lynn, now you might have turned Madame Fourcade's story into a novel. I know Alan First is a fan of yours. He provided a wonderful quote for the book, and he does that all the time.
Right, right. I didn't need to because even though this is a spy network, and intelligence networks, resistance networks aren't really written about that much. They're not that well known because, why? They're secret. They were doing secret things, and so people didn't keep written records. You know, that was very dangerous, you know, if the Gestapo found them. So there aren't a whole lot of records in the archives. But what was wonderful about this woman is that she wrote a memoir it was published in the late 1960s in French. There was a very, very bad English translation published here in the early 1970s, but the French version is, I read French, I don't speak it very well, but I read it, and it provided the detail that Elizabeth was talking about that's often absent, the day-to-day detail of what it was like to be running this network when you were fearing that the Gestapo, you knew the Gestapo was on your trail, and every day you woke up afraid that they were going to find you. And she talked very candidly about something. She talked about the fear she had. She talked about how she couldn't sleep. She had nightmares. She smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day. You know, she was rail thin, beautiful, but rail thin. So she talked about that, and so I got a lot of information about that. What she didn't talk about is a lot of things, including the fact that she had an affair with her number two, who was a dashing Air Force pilot. They fell in love. She got pregnant in the middle of the war. And while she was on the run from the Gestapo, she was pregnant and had the baby after 8 months of running from town to town to town, had the baby in Lyon, France, handed the child over to her female assistant who hid the baby away in the south of France while Marie Madeleine continued the work of being the leader of this network, and had to send her two older children out of France because of her fear that they were going to get captured by the Gestapo. And she never owns up in the book ever to the tremendous feeling of guilt that I know she felt. I mean, there are hints of it, but she refuses to acknowledge publicly what I'm sure was very, very true in private, of the pain that she had in not seeing her. She didn't see her kids for years. The pain of that, and the sense of guilt about basically putting them in the care of others, right, while she did this. But she truly felt that for those 5 years, the fate of her country was far more important than, not the fate of her children. She obviously loved her children, and they were in good care, but that it was more important for her to do what she was doing than to be with her kids.
Mm-hmm. There's a heartbreaking scene where she goes to the window and watches them drive away and be taken.
Yeah.
And she can't say anything.
Right. Her two older children, she had arranged for them to be smuggled out of France and into neutral Switzerland. And she couldn't even say goodbye to them because of the danger to them and to her. And so she had the same female assistant walk them by on the pavement underneath the window of the safe house she was staying in. And so she watched them, and looking absolutely helpless, they had no idea what was happening to them. And she said she felt like she was going to die of grief. And then she didn't even know that they were taken out of France by this organization. They were handed over to some peasants at the end who were supposed to get them across the border. And at the last minute, the peasants who were accompanying them they saw the border was swarming with Germans. So they told the kids, the boy was 12, the girl was 9, they told the kids they had to get across by themselves. And so the 12-year-old Christian got himself and his sister Beatrice across the border, and they made it into to Switzerland. And you can just imagine what Marie Madeleine thought when she actually found out about that. That was months later, but it was incredible.
Which goes to this question I like to think about myself is, if someone just landed on this stage from planet Xenon, and we'll start.
I mean, well, Frank can actually see that person. He's actually already there.
Frank has asked me to ask this question. What would you tell him the story is of our time? What is the story that we need to tell right now? We kind of know what Frank Baum thought because he created it, which was the story of Oz and a young girl. But, you know, I don't know if this will relate to another book you're working on, but I'm just, you know, I think that as writers, we're really writing the same story in a way and very different. And
I agree.
And if you can get this 10,000 foot view and put all the books, you know, what is that story? What are we after?
I think, you know, The Wizard of Oz, the Smithsonian called it America's first homegrown fairy tale. And so I have this whole kind of thing that I say about how it's so quintessentially American because you have our love for our agrarian past with the scarecrow, and then you have our love for mechanical and new futuristic gadgets with the Tin Man, and you have our questing spirit with the road, and then you have the courage of Dorothy, and you have the you know, the wizard who is also a humbug and a faker. And so it seems really like super American to me, right? Well.
Not to put too fine a point.
Not to put too fine a point on it. So what was really interesting was that yesterday I had somebody stood up and she had grown up in Russia. And she said that she grew up reading The Wizard of Oz and that it was really so Russian, the story, that everybody in Russia knew the story really well. And then I remembered that has actually happened to me several times, that people from different countries have told me that there's something about that story that resonated so much with them because of where they were from. You know, I think what his story was about really was about hope. And I think to me, because I had the pleasure of reading Madame Fourcade before it came out, it was also a story about hope. I mean, she is such a completely different person, but she, to me, that was what I got out of it. I thought she could see that it was worth doing everything she did because she had the hope that the future would be better. I read the same thing in your story.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, more of Doug Stanton's conversation with Lynn Olson, Elizabeth Berg, and Elizabeth Letts.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to my conversation with authors Elizabeth Berg, Elizabeth Letts, and Lynn Olson.
Elizabeth, you were talking, you know, Dorothy has the courage and et cetera, and then I thought the wizard is, you know, humbug. It's the men who are all in need of something. Let's talk about men for a moment. You know, because I made a joke. People in the lobby said, "Boy, you have your hands full tonight." And I said, "No, I don't. I just have to listen." And as a joke, though, I said to Elizabeth Letts, I said, "You know, I'm just going to get up there and mansplain the whole evening." And that'll... And you kind of laughed, but what you said was, well, Doug, that happens to me, especially with one of my World War II books. And I'd like you guys just to talk about this for a moment. I mean, because there's the world of publishing, there's the world of your readers, and it seems, however, your stories have bridged divides, but I mean, this is 2019, and that stuff happens. And I don't think we're aware enough of it, you know, the mansplaining of your World War II books, because a guy must know more about World War II than any.
Well, we have one of the foremost experts on World War II right here on the stage. And I was telling Lynn, it was really interesting. I received this really nice email a while back from a man who said that he was a retired social studies teacher, and he taught, he loved to read books about World War II. And he said and I hadn't met Lynn at the time, he said his two favorite authors about World War II were Lynn and me, which was very flattering to me because I've only written one book about it. But he did say, he said, I'm really interested that there are women writing about World War II, and I actively seek them out because I think that's great, which I thought was really nice. So I did write a book about World War II, but I think more to the point about this skepticism is this idea that people, and I've had a few women suggest it to me too, the idea that somehow Maud Baum wasn't worthy of having a book written about her.
Yeah, that goes to my question, the perception in publishing. Yeah.
Yeah, that somehow I should be writing about Frank, or at the very least about his mother-in-law, Matilda Jocelyn Gage, because they were, because they had done something. And I guess to me, somebody to do something, you can do something without having that thing be something that would put your name in the lights. So definitely, I think that's there. And I think sometimes too, there's this perception that if you are writing about women, and I noticed this going from World War II to the Finding Dorothy story, that somehow that means it's like a certain type of book. So sometimes I feel like when I'm writing about something like World War II, I get more people going like, oh, you must be really smart. But when I'm writing about something like the wife of a famous author, then they're kind of like, oh, that's one of those women's books.
And that's what I'm talking about, because there's no way that you can call any of your books, quote, women's books, which is demeaning in and of itself. And this only comes up because of our conversation in the lobby, but I'm saying that to our audience because I urge all of you to just approach these books as wonderful reading experiences in which you're transported. And that goes to our question about, go ahead.
It's so interesting that you asked this question, because today I got an email from a man who has, I have exchanged emails with. He's a fan of my books. And he said that today his men's book group read my book. And he said, I was stunned by some of the comments. And he, one in particular, a guy got up and said, it's just outrageous that she did this to her kids. And that, you know, there were so many other people who could have done this. Why did she do it? And he said, the man who was writing me said he just listened to this open mouthed, and he couldn't believe that this kind of comment was being made, and that there were other men who basically backed this guy up. And I just thought, I first of all, it kind of blows my mind too.
I wonder what would have happened if I had written the book. And would have made that comment.
I think they probably still would have, Doug, because it wasn't because a woman wrote the book. I don't think it was because a woman was doing what she was doing and violating, obviously standards that are still important to some people today. Uh-huh. And I keep saying to people, you would never have said anything like that if it were a man, that, you know, he abandoned his children, because that wasn't considered a male role. I mean, he wasn't supposed to take care of the kids. But I just think it points up that, actually, the truth of your question. I mean, the fact that it's still is still something that we have to grapple with.
It sits there, and we're not
today.
Quite aware of it. It doesn't always pop up.
Yeah, I mean, so much of today, I think we're of things that we weren't aware of that we didn't think were problems are cropping up. But I actually was blown away, you know, blown away by this, mm-hmm. this email too. I couldn't quite.
Let's hear the voice of your books that we've been talking about tonight. We've talked. Do each of you have a? Do we have our books to mm-hmm. read from yeah. on stage? Mm-hmm. Who would like to go first? What we'd love to do is hear your prose voice. And do you want to begin, Lynn?
Oh, well, yeah, I'll read a little bit. This is toward the end of the book, and I mentioned the fact that she had been captured twice by the Gestapo and escaped. This is the second time. This is by far the most dangerous experience she faced in the whole war. This was in July 1944. She was in Aix-en-Provence. This was after D-Day. But France had not yet been liberated. The Allies were still fighting hard in Normandy. They hadn't broken out yet. And so the Gestapo, the Germans were even more ruthless and because they were cornered. And so they were after her. And she was in Aix-en-Provence, and she was captured by the Gestapo. They knew she was a spy, but they didn't know she was Marie Madeleine Foucaud, who they had been looking for a very long time. And so they took her to a military barracks and put her in a jail cell in the barracks. And the next day, the top guy from the Gestapo in Marseille was going to come and interrogate her. And she knew if that happened, she was dead. I mean, she literally was going to be dead because he would find out who she was. And so she briefly considered taking a cyanide tablet that she had in her purse, but she knew if she did that the network would die too. So she thought, okay, maybe I'll think about escaping. And she grew up in Shanghai, and she remembered her father talking about Chinese robbers who would oil themselves, would cover themselves in oil so that they could slip through the bars of windows and gates to get into the houses that they wanted to get into. She was covered with sweat. It was hot. It was July. She was terrified. And so she basically thought, well, maybe I will try to do that too before I take the cyanide pill. So she went over to a barred window. Now, this was not a Gestapo prison. This was just an ordinary jail cell with bars, no glass, just bars over a window. She waited until about 3 a.m. when the guards outside her cell went off duty. Pushing the cot under the window, she picked up a large washing basin, turned it upside down, and put it onto the cot. After taking off all her clothes, she climbed onto the basin, a light summer dress clenched between her teeth. She managed to pull herself up and over the board. With her body tightly pinned between the board and the bars, she began trying to ease her head between the gaps. She kept doing this. Finally, her head went through. Just then, a German truck convoy lumbering down the street stopped outside the barracks directly opposite Marie Madeleine's window. She quickly pulled her head back through the opening with a pain so fierce she feared her ears had been torn off. It was the Gestapo, she thought. They'd come early, and they would find her pinned like a bug between the wooden board and the bars. An officer emerged from a staff car and shouted something at a sentry standing in front of the barracks, a few hundred feet from her window. With a great rush of relief, Marie Madeleine realized he was asking for directions. The convoy was not Gestapo, as it turned out, just an ordinary army unit that had gotten lost. After the convoy had gone, she again forced her way through the bars, an effort even more excruciating than before. With her body thick with perspiration, she squeezed one shoulder through, then her right leg. The most searing pain came when she began easing her displaced hip through. As she worked at it, she told herself that the agony of torture would be far worse than what she was enduring now. Miraculously, she succeeded and found herself out on the ledge with her dress still gripped between her teeth. As she jumped to the ground, the soft thud of her feet alerted the sentry, who clicked on his flashlight and shouted, "Who's there?" She lay flat, and the beam of the flashlight passed above her. When the sentry finally turned it off and moved away, she wrapped her dress around her neck and scuttled on her knees like a crab across the street. On the other side, she jumped up, put on her dress, and ran off, stumbling in the darkness.
Wow. Tough.
Very tough.
Really Yes.
Okay. Oh, that, phew, that's so good. Okay, this is a very brief section. Arthur is 85, as I told you. His neighbor, Lucille, is 83, and she's had something quite sad happen to her. And they're sitting out on the porch in rocking chairs and talking. And Lucille says, "It's so embarrassing to be useless." "Why, you're not useless," Arthur says. "Yes, I am." "You're just going through a hard time." "Yes, I am. But also, I am useless. I do nothing. I realized this was happening some time ago, everything falling off, but I made do. I had church, I read books and the paper. I had my garden. But all the lights are off now, and I really don't want to live anymore, Arthur. What's left for me now? I am useless, and so are you." Arthur straightens in his chair, indignant. "I'm not useless." "You are, too. All you do is go and visit your wife at the graveyard every single day. That's all you do." "Well, first of all, I don't think it's useless to visit Nola. It is my great pleasure and honor to go to the resting place of the finest woman I ever knew and think about the boundless glory of my life with her." "Okay, I'm sorry I said that. I know how you feel about Nola. I know how much it means for you to go and visit her." "No, you don't," Arthur says. "Nobody knows how much it means to me except maybe her. And apart from that, I am not useless." "But what do? You don't even go to church." Arthur rocks for a while. Lucille's chair has gone still, but Arthur rocks for a while. "Let me ask you something," he says finally. "What?" "Did you ever hear anyone say they wanted to be a writer?" "Yes, I've heard lots of people say that." Arthur stops his rocking to look over at her. "But what we need are readers, right? Where would writers be without readers? Who are they going to write for? And actors, who are they without an audience? Actors, painters, dancers, comedians, even just ordinary people doing ordinary things. What are they without an audience of some sort? See, that's what I do. I am the audience. I am the witness. I am the great appreciator. That's what I do, and that's all I want to do. I worked for a lot of years. I did a lot of things for a lot of years. Now, well, here I am in the rocking chair, and I don't mind it, Lucille. I don't feel useless. I feel lucky."
What a treat. It's kind of like walking through a candy store and you say, "I'll have that one and that one."
Okay, I'm going to just read a little bit from the part where, so Maude Baum has gone to the MGM studios and she's kind of talked her way onto the lot, and she has gotten Louis B. Mayer to say that he will introduce her to the character who's going to play Dorothy. And they've just come in and the character who's going to play Dorothy is getting ready to sing a song. "For a small girl, she had a big mouth," Maude thought. "And when she opened it, the sound she made was twice as big as she was. The notes started low and then took flight, showcasing the girl's voice as it ascended. Maude could feel it vibrating deep within her chest, an emotion as much as a sound. She was so struck by the tone that at first she didn't think about the words, but as she tuned into the lyrics, her face flushed. The song was about a rainbow? Where on earth had those lyrics come from? There were no rainbows in The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. Nobody knew about the rainbow beside herself and Frank. She felt a momentary flicker that there was something familiar in this girl, in this tune. But the piano hit a false note, the girl frowned, and the sensation faded. The piano player stopped, trying out several chord progressions. Maud looked around the room, half expecting to see Frank. Wouldn't that be just like him, popping his head out from behind a doorway, eyes a twinkle? Maud loosened her collar, slipped off her sweater. Of course Frank was not going to appear here at Metro in 1938. He'd been gone for almost 20 years. Maud knew that perfectly well. She wasn't crazy. Her mind was as sharp as ever. She shifted in her seat, corrected her posture, folded her hands in her lap. After several false starts, the piano player went on, sounding out complex, resonant chords that shifted through elegant progressions. The girl's big voice effortlessly filled the room. When she stopped singing, the silence that followed seemed like the plain sister of a beautiful girl. Peering at Mayer from under her dark fringe of lashes, the girl was clearly hoping for a note of affirmation. "Oh, my little hunchback certainly can sing. Come over and give Daddy a hug," he said. She slowly uncoiled from her stool, unveiling a glimpse of the woman she would soon become. Then, younger again, she rushed toward him, flinging her arms around the short man so that she knocked his glasses askew. Maud watched the spectacle uncomfortably. The girl looked to be at least 15 and was surely too old to be quite so affectionate to a grown man who wasn't her father.
We can continue this conversation in the lobby with all three authors. I want to thank you all for coming. I want to thank you for really changing my life and opening my eyes and just giving me some great reading experiences. I hope that we see you back here again.
Well, so thank you.
Don't
we
be a stranger.
Thank you,
yeah.
Doug, for great moderating and for organizing all of this.
Yeah, well, thank you all.
That was Elizabeth Letts, Elizabeth Berg, and Lynn Olson talking with Doug Stanton. Elizabeth Letts' latest novel is Finding Dorothy. Elizabeth Berg's is Night of Miracles, the sequel to The Story of Arthur Truelove. And Lynn Olson wrote Madame Foucault's Secret War. Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economicology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org. And listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.